The price of college, like homes, has been ramping up significantly, and that makes the decisions around paying for it and how to pay for it that much more complicated. And what we know from colleges themselves about how and why different people pay different amounts for tuition, it's pretty much clear as mud. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 as we take on this conversation. Are you a student or a parent or a grandparent shopping around for colleges? What questions do you have about how much higher education costs and what you should be thinking about? Call 800-642-1234 or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Ron Lieber. He wants to help people better understand why college costs what it does and how to make the price more affordable. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, and his new book is called The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You use the word price in even the title of your book. It's important to note the distinction between the words cost and price when we deal with college. Why?
Well, the price is what some people refer to when they're talking about the list price before any discounts that come from need-based financial aid or merit aid that has more to do with, say, your grades and your SAT scores. When people talk about costs, at least in higher education world, they're talking about the costs that are required to educate a student, the budget, right? But these words often get tossed around interchangeably by parents who should not be faulted for not knowing any better. But when you're listening to people talk about this, it's important to define for yourself and to clarify exactly what they are actually speaking about.
So is it fair to say that the cost of college has gone up?
So the cost of educating undergraduates has indeed gone up. And the biggest reason that it has gone up is because the people who do the work are expensive. Why are they expensive? Because they train for a large number of years to become qualified to be tenured or tenure track professors. And, you know, basic economics suggests that people would not train for that long if there wasn't some sort of above average compensation coming their way. The other reason that the cost has come up is that in general, there is a larger number of administrators, not professors, but administrators in these institutions for every 1,000 undergraduates. Why is that? Because there are more regulations than there used to be about fair and equal treatment of students, and staying in compliance requires well-trained people to keep an eye on things. And then there are also the demands that families themselves are making for bigger and better computer networks and bigger and better mental health counseling centers and bigger and better career planning offices. And all of those offices require staffing, require more administrators, and not just 23-year-olds, but actually people who are, you know, well-trained and experienced. And so that is the biggest reason why the cost of educating undergraduates has risen.
So there are real changes that have happened maybe since the adults in these circumstances went to college themselves or knew people who went to college. We can't necessarily make assumptions based on the way things used to be.
I think that's right. And one of the things that's changed dramatically is that, you know, when you go to the state house or the state houses all over America, one of the easiest things to cut in a recession is the subsidy that the state government itself supplies to the public university system. So we saw it in 2009, 2010, 2011 with that brutal recession. Subsidies from the state were cut. And when that happens, you face a difficult decision as a university administrator. You can either raise prices to students or you can cut back programs and fire a bunch of people so that you don't have to raise prices. Many institutions did both of them. We are now in the middle of another recession, albeit a very different one, the origin of it was different, right? But the result is going to be the same, which is that states are going to get less money in tax revenue. And when that happens, the easiest thing for them to do is to sort of stick it to the state university system and let those administrators figure it out. And so we are likely to see tuition hikes and perhaps cutbacks yet again.
Okay, so the costs of college have gone up, and yet you write that the amount people are actually paying the price has not gone up quite at the same level, even though the list price, as you call it, might be higher. How does that work?
Yeah, so this gets confusing, right?
All of this stuff is confusing when dealing with college costs and what you pay and where you get your loans and all of it. It's a real, like, really complicated thing that we expect people who are, you know, 17, 18, 19 to take on.
I sense a growing sense of exasperation in your voice, Keely, and I am so glad to hear it, right? Because all of this is way too complicated, and it's not your fault as a parent. It's not my fault as a parent. It's not the fault of the well-meaning administrators who inherited the system. It's maybe the fault of some of the state legislators that want to stick it to the university budgets, but we'll try not to get political here. The fact of the matter is this, right? The list prices at many of these institutions have gone to the moon. And indeed, if you are running the show at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and your state subsidy gets cut in a recession, it is very tempting to raise the price for out-of-state students to the moon in the hopes that a whole bunch of affluent families from the San Fernando Valley in California and from Long Island and from the North Shore of Chicago are going to be willing to pay that higher price because their kids really love Madtown, right? So that is a tempting thing to do. Now, at the state level, right, in-state students, maybe they are continuing to qualify for, or more of them are qualifying for, you know, academic discounts based on their own circumstances. Maybe their financial circumstances and their decreased assets in a recession has caused them to qualify for more need-based aid of various sorts. So much depends on who you are and where you're coming from. And if you're a private institution, right, if you're Lawrence University, if you're Beloit College, if you are Knox College in Illinois, if you're Grinnell in Iowa, you're in a market, you're competing with other schools, and you have to sort of hand out discounts accordingly to bridge the difference between people's ability to pay for your list price and their willingness to do so. And that plays out in secret, in background, on a year-to-year and sometimes day-to-day basis. And it's not easy to understand.
Ron Lieber's new book is called The Price You Pay for College. We're talking about it now, and there's room for you in this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic changed how you are looking at college experiences or what you might want to get out of it, what you want for your kids? Have you or someone you know made a change in the middle of college because of the pandemic or because of the money? We'd love to hear your experience. You can call 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Ron, saving, how do we gauge it effectively when we don't even know what the price of college is going to be when kids or grandkids reach the right age?
It's an almost impossible problem. And so I encourage people just to kind of break it in chunks and try to guess, if you have a small child, what it is that you might be able to provide and might be willing to provide, you know, come 15 years from now. And there's a financial planner up in Eau Claire named Kevin McKinley, who presented a very compelling and relatively simple way of thinking about this to me years ago, which I still refer to. And he just suggests dividing it up into chunks, right? So if your goal is to get your kid to Madison, you know, 15 years from now, and you figure that, you know, the all-in cost is, let's call it $100,000 in today's dollars, if you don't get any need-based aid or any merit aid, right? Think about dividing it into thirds. Save a third in the first 18 years of their lives. Spend a third out of your current income when they're in college, and then borrow a third divided between the parent or parents and the student equally, right? Now, you can mess around with those fractions any way you want. But once you start sort of breaking it down that way, you realize, oh, I can probably come up with that amount of money if I actually commit to it when my kid is born by saving roughly $75 a month, right? You put it in a 529 college savings plan, maybe 60% of it is in stocks. You get some growth there over 18 years, and you can save that third. And it starts to feel doable. All the better if there's a grandparent around who wants to throw $20 a month at the challenge as well. Even $20 a month can make a big difference over time.
We've got Dave in Ironwood, Michigan, who's ready to join the conversation about paying for college. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. What I saw in Michigan was the money from the state was steady, but I saw I used to work at a junior college, and I questioned the fact that only certain faculty were getting the raises and other faculty, like me, were taking freezes. There was sort of a collusionary aspect of management and the teachers' union only rewarding certain professors with increases. And then every year the tuition would go up, and I saw that as fraudulent.
Yeah, Dave, thank you for sharing that. I'm sorry I jumped in right there, but I wanted to get Ron's response, because I think Dave speaks to a point more specifically that a lot of people have that says, we're paying all this money into college. What are you using the money on?
Yeah. So, you know, in the same way that every school exists in a marketplace, every person offering their labor in that institution is itself part of, a marketplace for labor there. And some people and some groups have more leverage than others. And sometimes it does not seem fair. But the fact of the matter is that there is a lot of unequal and I would argue unfair treatment of faculty and teaching labor out there in the marketplace. There are all sorts of people who are brought in on what's known as an adjunct basis, right? They're paid maybe $2,000 or $3,000 per course, and they have to string together 8 or 10 or 16 courses over the course of a year in order to just scrape together a living. A lot of these adjunct faculty qualify for food stamps, right? And as a consumer of higher education, even if you do not have a moral and ethical issue with contingent labor in this way, still, are you getting your money's worth, right? Is that teacher going to be around in a year to write your kid a recommendation for grad school or to help them get a job? Will they be around in 2 years to continue a mentorship relationship that might have been started in the classroom? If an institution is using a lot of adjunct labor, you may not be getting what you think you're buying when it comes to a continuity of relationship with that faculty member or with faculty overall.
Dave, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. If you've got an experience like Dave or you've got a question when we're talking about the cost of college, now's the time, 800-642-1234. What are you struggling with in making decisions about choosing a college or continuing to go to a college? Or what are you thinking about whether you have kids or you just recognize that this is something that we're up against as communities? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking with Ron Lieber, who is the author of Your Money column for the New York Times. He's got a new book out about paying for college. We continue this conversation ahead on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the price you pay for college. That's the title of the new book by our guest, New York Times financial columnist Ron Lieber. We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That number again is 800-642-1234. Go ahead and give us a call now if you've got a question. Ron, you were just talking about the fact that some colleges don't manage their money well, and you might not be getting what you pay for. The other part of this is that you might not be learning as much as you think, or your kid might not learn as much as you had hoped going to college. You have a whole chapter about that in your book.
One of the things that was astounding for me when I started diving into the data is that, on an institution-wide basis, very few of these colleges are, testing people on the way in and testing them on the way out to find out, just how much, sort of smarter or more capable they are, at the end. And what I'm talking about are, sort of more overarching kind of critical thinking and analysis skills, not the more micro things that you can test for, on a biology exam or in an English paper. And when a couple of really sharp researchers who are in the academy themselves spent years tracking this down. What they discovered is that at many institutions, many people are not making a lick of progress. And I just found that amazing, right? But then again, if you take a step back, you know, what these academic, quote unquote, academic institutions don't really like to acknowledge is that there are a lot of people who go to college just for the kinship, right? The friendship, the connections, the mentorship, and the credential, right? And not so much for the learning and the intellectual roller coaster at all, right? And I make no judgments about people who choose college or pursue college in that way. But the schools both don't like to acknowledge that it goes on and then don't do very much to prove that people are actually smarter on the other end. And I found that surprising. Hmm.
We've got Kathy in Madison who is ready to join our conversation now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. So I got a child that's going to graduate in high school in June and very bright. And, you know, I don't even know where to start as far as trying to get her apply for colleges and where to find these resources, you know, as far as maybe getting some financial help. I did save $100 a month when she was born, so I got that. So I got some starter money, but only about $25K. And I know that's not going to cover 4 years. So I guess, where do you start? Where do you start?
Kathy, I don't think you're alone in that. Ron, some quick advice for Kathy.
Well, sure. Not every 18-year-old is ready to go to college. Not every 18-year-old should go to college right away. And not every 18-year-old should go to college at all. And, you know, if you have a teenager on your hands who just has no idea and doesn't seem motivated to apply, it might be because there's something else they should be doing in the world, at least for a little while. And there's no shame in that. And there's no harm in that. In fact, it might be good for them because a lot of 18-year-olds have no business in college and we're wasting money the money that we spend sending them there, forcing them there, wedging or nudging them in when they may not be ready.
Well, and especially then if they have to accrue any sort of loans and then they don't wind up with a degree that they can use to make more money and pay them back. I mean, that's a big problem with our student loan crisis right now.
Exactly. It is the worst of all worlds to go to college and to borrow money to be there and then not to finish because you're not ready or you don't know what you want, because then you end up with the debt that you have to repay, but you don't end up with the increased earnings that come from actually having the degree.
Ron Lieber, if our caller's child says, no, I absolutely want to go to college, should they start regionally? Should they start by trying to figure out what how much each college costs? Should they call the actual college? I mean, where do you begin? Is it an online search or a phone call or something else?
Well, it begins with a guidance counselor at your high school. Some of these counselors do heroic work, even though they often have hundreds of students who report into them. So, you know, do your level best to get that person's attention. You know, talk to them about the things that you're interested in studying, you know, the kind of student that you've been so far. And hopefully that person has some suggestions and some instructions for you. One of the next things you can do financially, right, is think about the most likely destination, right? So, you know, you're thinking about UW-Milwaukee. So every one of these schools has what's called a net price calculator. And so you go to Google and you type in University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee net price calculator, and out pops a calculator. Every school has to have one. And you put in a bunch of your financial data and it predicts for you about what sort of need-based financial aid you might qualify for you. So that begins to give you a sense of, okay, well, I've managed to put away $100 for 18 years a month. So that's what I have saved. What might this institution ask me to pay for each of 4 years, right? And then you can begin to think about, all right, well, how much am I comfortable borrowing, if anything? And then my kid can take out, you know, roughly $30,000 in federal student loans. How much might they earn? How much can I contribute out of earnings? And then you can start to do some math and see what's affordable. And if going to a four-year school for all 4 years isn't affordable, then you can start with community college and do it that way.
We've got Meg in Presque Isle ready to talk with us. Hey, Meg.
Hi, thank you. I have a question. online learning, community college versus an accredited university. It's all very confusing. What is the value and what is the importance of choosing? Because online learning is really affordable, but I'm going into psychotherapy. I want to know that my degree is going to get me a good job.
Meg, thank you so much for the question. And Ron, we've got about a minute left. How do you balance the online degrees with accredited universities in person?
Sure. So if the object of the game is to get into a clinical psychology PhD program, those PhD programs are extremely choosy, and chances are you're going to be better situated to apply for grad school if you go into the, you know, kind of the most selective or prestigious university you can get into, or, you know, go to your state university and just shoot the lights out and get the attention of, you know, the best psychology professor that you can to write you a recommendation for later. Now, if the object of the game is, to graduate with the lowest amount of debt, get into the lowest price, you know, Master of Social Work program and become a therapist that way, then, you know, you may want to start a community college or maybe even with a 4-year online degree and then take your shot at the MSW master's degree programs that way, because those programs can be kind of expensive. So, you know, it kind of depends on your goal.
Sure. Meg, thanks so much for the question. And Ron, thank you for joining us today for the good conversation and also some practical tips in here.
It's my pleasure.
That's Ron Lieber. You can find his regular Your Money column in the New York Times. And we talked with him today about his new book, The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make.